You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Nate Klug. Nate, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks, Brainerd.
So, Nate, you're in Albany, California. I didn't know there was an Albany, California. And we were talking before the interview about New Haven and different places. So what's it like, before we jump into your work and writing, what is it like in Albany, California, in terms of the arts, I guess, the community?
So Albany's just north of Berkeley. So it's a small little town that's basically indistinguishable, but it's great to be near University of California, Berkeley, and Oakland, and then San Francisco. I think we moved here 4 years ago, and I had hardly been out to the Bay Area at all, and so I knew there's so many poets that come from here that whose work I really loved, and so it's been exciting. I mean, I think sometimes there's almost too many writers out here. It can feel like there's something going on every day, but overall, I think it's a good place to be.
And what are you working on at the moment? What's occupying your creative world?
Yeah, so I'm working on finishing up a new book of poems. My first book of non-translated poems came out in 2015, and so I've had like the last 4 or 5 years where I've been done with that manuscript and working on new stuff. I'm a pretty slow writer, and so it's common for me to have just a few poems that are kind of new every season or two even, and so it's just a slow process of creating new work and looking back on it and making sure that it feels good enough to be in the next book. And then also the real challenge for me is kind of once I have enough where it feels like a critical mass to start thinking in terms of like themes and some sort of overall cohesive organization, because I really just write lyric poems, so it feels like each one is kind of distinct and one-off. And but then when you want to start putting it together into a book, you have to think more thematically.
And let's talk a little bit about, but I know you're going to read a little bit today, but you said you're producing about 2 poems a season, which sounds like a, I don't want to say a slow pace, but it sounds like a very measured pace. So to talk a little bit about how you work, are there a lot of drafts? How do you go through it? So there is only 2. I'd imagine there could be more, there could be less, but that's a pace that seems really careful. What is that?
Yeah, I mean, I wish there were more. I've never quite been a writer who is writing something new every day. It feels like the gift of poetry, and it does feel like a gift when it's present in my life. It's usually my poems start with just a phrase or a string of sounds that comes into my head. It can be related to an experience I've had, if taking a trip with my family or something. The poem could start out of that experience, or it could be more kind of abstract or related to something I'm reading. But it really is, it starts with kind of a phrase or two, and it's very sonic, and it often feels like I'm just kind of following the trail of the sounds before I know much about what the poem is about or wants to mean or anything like that. So it's tremendously exciting to be working on something, and it feels like really physically thrilling because it is so rooted in sound, I think. But it is rare. So I don't know if it would feel less special if I was like blessed with it all the time.
And rooted in sound, I know that's because of the the way you write, the kind of songs, but what started that? And I want to jump in and hear one of your poems soon, but what started that association with sound, with the lyric, because that's something that's marked all of your work, really. And there's, of course, other poets like that, but not all. How did that begin, that interest in sound?
Yeah, I think it just came out of the work that I loved most. You know, I grew up in a household where my parents were both readers, and I was exposed to a fair bit of poetry. And then kind of towards my later teenage years, I really started reading it and loving it on my own. And, you know, poets like Emily Dickinson and Gerard Manley Hopkins and Gwendolyn Brooks, they all felt like they were constantly engaged with sound, and there was a pleasure there that I appreciated even before I understood really what the poem was about. And so, yeah, it's kind of like you want to emulate what you love.
So let's hear one of these poems. What is it that you're going to be reading from? What's this next poem that you're going to read?
I thought I would just read a few from my first book, which is called Anyone, which came out in 2015 from the University of Chicago Press. And I'll just start with this really short one. It's just one sentence that takes up about half a page. And it's called Milton's God. And there's a famous book of literary criticism that's called Milton's God by William Empson that I really love. And what I was drawn to, you know, if you read Milton or if you read Paradise Lost, and I studied theology, of course, and what I was drawn to there was the sense of paradox, most of all, the sense of something that was, you know, God is both very present and then very removed and very absent. So a few of the poems in this book kind of try to get at that paradox. This one in particular. So Milton's God. Where I-95 meets the pike, a ponderous thunderhead flowered, stewed a minute, then flipped like a flash card, tattered edges crinkling in, linings so dark with excessive bright, that standing, waiting at the overpass edge, the onlooker couldn't decide until the end, or even then, what was revealed and what had been hidden.
Thank you. That's such an interesting piece to talk about now. So you were talking, of course, about Milton, and we're talking about God, and I know you also went to Yale Divinity School, which seems that all informs this. To get into that a little bit, it sounds like we're talking about the seen or unseen, but I don't know a lot about theology or even Milton, but in this poem, it sounds like it's referencing both. Is that the case?
Yeah, and it takes, it has this phrase, so dark with excessive bright, and that comes straight from Paradise Lost, which was Milton's kind of epic poem. He called it, he basically thought he was kind of rewriting the Bible, which is this kind of crazily ambitious project to undertake. But again, this sense of paradox that, and I put it as a description of this enormous cloud, you know, so the scene of the poem is this onlooker standing on an overpass, you know, in between two highways, and you don't quite know what the onlooker is doing. There's a sort of hint of, you know, an act of desperation or something. But there's this huge cloud, and it's at once both dark and extremely bright. You know, it's dark because it's extremely bright, and that is the way that the divine is spoken about often in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and that kind of amazing sense of paradox, has always fascinated me.
Excellent. Yeah, that is kind of the fascinating paradox of I guess Judeo-Christian belief, but also, I would imagine other schools of belief as well. And so I know you. There's another poem you're going to read, or two more. What is the next one from?
Sure. I'll read. We were talking about New Haven. I'll read this poem that I wrote when I was living there, and this is a much more kind of personal poem. It comes out of the experience of seeing my wife. I think we were married then, or we were engaged, or we were about to get married, and I saw her one day just riding a bicycle through town, and you know, we were both out and about. We didn't know our schedules, and I just saw her, and I made the decision kind of just to watch her. I was standing far enough away that she wouldn't see me unless I yelled or waved, and just that chance to kind of be a stranger to someone whom you know and love, and usually aren't a stranger to. That was the experience that was the seed of this poem. So it's called Observer, and it refers to, in the middle, the kind of the idea in physics of the observer effect, where, you know, photons behave differently whether or not they're being observed. Observer. Not seeing me, not even looking, Kay on her silver cruiser charms her way through the last long moment of the changing light. Snow boots and the Seychelles warbler's old blue tights, a rolled up yoga mat in her basket wobbling like a wild tiller as she pedals. It feels illicit and somewhat right to stand across the intersection without shouting her name or even waving. According to the internet tutorial, the fact that photons turn into tiny, loyal billiard balls as soon as we start watching suggests no error of method or measurement, but rather, as far as anyone can tell, an invisibly unstable world, a shaking everywhere that seeing must pin down and fix. So, that moment I stumbled on you, out alone, bending through the traffic at Orange and Edwards Streets, a someone else then, whom I alone can never otherwise see. There has to be a kind of speech beyond naming or even praise, a discipline that locates light and lets it go.
Thank you, Nate. Very beautiful, very beautiful. Of course, quite different from the other one. I'm so glad you chose that. So this is, you know, really a love poem, it feels to me,
yeah.
Of course, but also... yeah, about that idea of seeing or not seeing, you know, that always, I found that to be such a difficult concept, and still do, what you mentioned at the beginning about photons, about them, you know, our observing them then changes something about it, making observation itself seem like an intrusion, or at least that's something that makes it impossible to do objectively. I never quite got that, but is that the basic idea with observing photon? That was a concept that always seemed endlessly fascinating, but that also is something that I can never seem to quite get what it means.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm kind of no expert on this either, and that's why in the poem I put, you know, I introduced that sentence with "according to the internet tutorial," so that, you know, there's this implication that the speaker of the poem kind of looked this up quickly, like on YouTube, which I did.
Right.
And you know, so trying to kind of, it's a fascinating idea. I think I feel similarly to you that I'm, you know, I'm definitely a novice on it, but that, I think that is the basic understanding. And you know, whether or not I'm sure physicists would complicate our understanding of it, but it seems metaphorically useful. I feel like that's what poets are doing all the time, is trying to find these metaphors that are, you know, that are true to whatever experience they're engaging, at least on one level.
So so thank you for that. And you have another one. What is the next poem from?
Yeah. I'll read this one, which is called Anyone, and this is the title poem of the book. And so after we were in New Haven, Connecticut, we moved to Des Moines, Iowa, which was a big change. And I was actually working, I was working at a congregation out in this small town called Grinnell. And so I went from the sort of this urban, gritty environment to the prairie, and a lot more silence and a much wider sky. And that definitely informed a lot of the work. And this one is again, a poem of observation, poem of seeing. The fireflies in Iowa in the summertime are unbelievable. And actually, now that we live in California, I miss them so much because there aren't fireflies here. Yeah, that's enough to say about this one. It's called Anyone. Though severed from their source, fireflies at the edge of the yard retain lightning silence. The way one flash can confound distance, turning the roadside corn stalks white for a garish moment, while I-80's night trucks punch past, bearing John 316 and Tyson. Tonight, from a stranger's porch, we watch the tiny orbs form from sifting dark, flittings so regular they felt elemental, one part with the air, as though it were our eyes that flickered, eventually gave out. Why, when light in such compression chooses to betray itself, does it seem aimed not at particular conditioned attention, but at anyone, anyone it pleases?
Thank you. Yeah, that's very lovely too. And I mean, because of your background, it's hard not to interpret that in a sense of theology. But the ending almost sounds like light. The fact that light has no preference is a kind of grace almost. I mean, I don't want to read too much into this or what's happening there, but it feels like there's a kind of a beautiful. I'm not sure what the word I'm reaching for is, but some kind of generosity about light's reach to some extent.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, I think folks who do come from, you know, whether or not they identify as people of faith, but if they have some sort of literacy in religious tradition, they get that metaphorically. That is one of the things, maybe the main thing that I'm trying to describe at the end. You know, grace is like this, such a hard thing to talk about, which makes it such a fascinating subject for me, for poetry.
And when you're working with different communities, so now that you're a writer, graduate, you're working within different churches as a priest, or can you speak to that a little bit? What is your
role? Yeah, so I'm not a priest. I'm a Protestant minister. I'm part of the Congregational Church. So that was a tradition that developed as a sort of dissenting church from out of the Protestant Reformation. So puts a big emphasis on individual belief and kind of freedom of belief and expression. And, you know, in America, you know, they were the ones who sort of founded a bunch of our different colleges like Harvard and Yale and Oberlin and Grinnell and all the way out to California. So it's a neat tradition for me because it's a very literary tradition. And I don't know, most of the time it's a good gig for a poet. You know, I knew I would never be able to make a living only on my writing. And so I get to have this other job where I meet interesting people, and I get to do a lot of writing every week for
sermons.
You
do sermons every week that in a way is not unlike poetry. I mean, I've never written a sermon. I don't know how to approach one, but I would imagine that's also an approach that's not unlike poetry, because we're not
right.
Trying to really kind of give instructions or kind of nail it literally. or are you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, metaphor is very important in sermons. I tell a lot of stories in my sermons, which I haven't done so much in my poems, though I think I'm getting better at it. I think maybe writing sermons is helping me incorporate narrative into my poems more. But exactly what you said in terms of, you know, approaching this great, mysterious, invisible subject, you know, trying to use all these different artful techniques to make people experience something. And, yeah, church can be, I think, people from the outside, you know, have this experience of it being this kind of staid institution. And so I really don't want it to be boring. So I work really hard to make my sermon something that feel engaging and that kind of helps people feel alive, hopefully.
And is sermons really only, I mean, immediately my thought is, I wish I could hear one, but there is, it's really a live experience, right? I mean, I suppose they're written down, but sermons seem to only be reaching in general a live audience. Is that correct? Or would you collect, let's say, a book of them?
Yeah, I would never publish my sermons in the way that I would want to publish my poems. Some people do, but to me, the form is this transitory thing where you get up, every week and you deliver it, and it's there in the air between us for, 15 minutes, and then it's gone. I mean, we do record sermons so people who miss it or are out of town can listen online, but and sometimes people ask me to send the text to them, and I always say, well, try to just listen to it online, because I think that's to me the preferred medium, the auditory.
Yeah, so interesting. So, Nate, I want to thank you for reading those, and I also want to ask you one more question, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
I am. I was just in the Midwest with my wife for a conference, and I brought along this book that I'd read once before, and it's really great to be revisiting, which is called Austerlitz by W.G. Sebald. Maybe it's pronounced Sebald, but it's sort of a novel that's all about travel and memory, and he's a favorite of a lot of poets just because kind of the way his work is so associative. It doesn't really have a plot, but it kind of jumps from image to theme, much in the way that poems do. I also really am a fan of this Canadian poet named Karen Solis, and she just had a new book come out called the Capely Caves. And I just finished up reading that book, but it's definitely something I'll return to as well because I like her work so much.
Thank you, Nate. Thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate your time and your work.
Oh, thank you, Brainerd. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.